Hello and welcome. This is Pastor Ken Ortiz, and I thank you for joining me in my latest podcast. This series of podcasts is entitled What the World's Coming To. And amazingly, this is our 50th installment, 50th episode, in which I have talked about things that are going on in the world that I think Christians should take note of as we look forward to and anticipate the second coming of Jesus Christ. Something that seems to be significantly missing in much of Christian theology today is the idea that we are living in the end times. At least it seems like they are the end times to people like me who take the Bible seriously as well as literally. Jesus talked about events that would transpire in the world, and he said, when you see those events, you should be watching. You should lift up your eyes, literally to lift up your eyes to heaven in expectation of the coming of Jesus Christ. Clearly, if you pay any attention to the media, regardless of which media you read, you realize that the world is in a state of increasing turmoil. Jesus said the end times would be like that. There would be wars and rumors of wars. He said, but he also said in Luke's gospel in chapter 21 that men would be living in a perplexity. That is, that they have problems without any apparent solutions. And he went on to say that some men's hearts would be failing them for fear of the things that they see coming on the world. We may not be completely to that degree, but we're seeing a lot of hysteria. We're seeing a lot of reactionaryism on both sides of the fence. And there seems to be a real power struggle for the hearts and minds and literally the souls of mankind. There are those of us who believe that not only is the pits of hell being emptied out of their evil vermin who are preying upon the earth, demons basically inspiring and spreading their doctrines and influencing behaviors and decisions of the worst kind, but also we see that there's some real challenges coming within the church. In fact, I was struck today, I was reading in one publication where they were talking about how 140 Christian leaders from the United States had sent an open letter to President Biden asking him to force a ceasefire and stop supplying Israel with military weapons so that they could bring the end of the what they called the genocide in Gaza. It's kind of amazing because as I looked at the names when they began to list those who were the authors or the writers, signers on this letter, that they were all people that I would consider apostates. They come from apostate denominations. They come from apostate organizations. And so it makes complete sense. But we're finding also that there is really a real separation that's growing amongst the Christians in the sense of there are those who are serious biblical Christians, and then there are others who have some kind of historical or professional or career associations. And so we find in a sense that that separation, if we might call it the sheep and the goats, as Jesus talked about in Matthew 25, is taking place, that we're seeing that God is removing his spirit from many of those organizations. I don't call them churches, they're just organizations. But something else I read this last week was in Foreign Affairs magazine, which I've subscribed to. It's an interesting magazine because it presents perspectives on what's going on in the world written by different writers, and I think it's fairly representative of the points of view. I certainly don't agree with all of the points of view that are presented or the approaches that are recommended by those who write the articles, but in a way I kind of appreciate that because you get both sides of the arguments and the equation. You certainly see the different points of view. And I find that's kind of, you know, hard to do anymore because it seems like every institution or organization that prevents information tends to lean very heavily on one side of the argument and not really give you a chance to hear what the other side has to say. But this one was referring to an article written by a gentleman by the name of Edward Lukwa, who is a, they call him, he's an historian and a geostrategist. And he makes an observation that I think few of us could disagree with. He said, the world is awash in conflict, strife, and instability. Coups, civil wars, and insurgencies have broken out across the continents, and millions have been displaced or are in need of humanitarian aid as a result. The rash of hostilities, their human toll, and the threats they pose to the international order has prompted outside observers to call for a range of interventions, from sending more arms to ceasefires to negotiated settlements. But then he adds, but external involvement in conflicts often prolongs the suffering. Now, his suggestion is something that I think kind of nihilistic, where he says we should just step back and let the combatants exhaust themselves until they finally decide to quit doing what they're doing. I understand that, because it doesn't seem like anything we do works. But the failure of solutions that we find in the world is not because men haven't tried, but it's because we live in a sinful world that's filled with sinful people who are controlled by evil forces oftentimes. And this world that we live in is a doomed planet, if you will, not because of global warming and climate change, but it's a doomed planet because, as Paul said in Romans 8, the whole creation is groaning and travailing, awaiting one moment in time when the sons of God will be made manifest. In other words, when we are redeemed and we're adopted into the kingdom of Christ. So in a way, I think as Christians, we need to keep in mind that when the world becomes darker, that believers need to go deeper. And that's really part of my objective as a pastor, as a leader, is I want to help people really begin to prepare themselves for whatever is coming in the future, because the Bible says the end times will get worse and worse, that evil men will increase in number and they'll become more diabolical, that we aren't looking for a great, big, beautiful tomorrow until Christ comes. And so I think that, as Paul said, as sin does abound, so does grace much more abound. I think that we need to understand that as the world becomes darker, we as followers of Jesus need to strive to go deeper into our relationship with God and our trust and confidence in Him, because we can't trust in worldly leaders. And this is my caution, I would say, to many Christians. I think that we look to a singular leader to come over and take over our country and bring to an end the quite obviously evil and wicked regime that has an agenda that's anti-Christian. Not only against Christians, but against the whole agenda of Scripture. So, you know, we're facing that dilemma. It's not new. It's been here, but it's become really overt in the last few years. And I think it's important for you and I as followers of Jesus Christ to recognize that our answer is not found in a political solution. Now, I'm not saying that politics don't play a part, or I'm not even suggesting that we should become politically disengaged. We have certain citizen responsibilities, and I won't take time to go into that. I think I've covered that in other presentations. But the whole point is that what we want is leaders who are godly. We want men and women who fear God. And whether that's the case or not, I don't know. But I would say singularly, when it comes to an election, you know, usually we have to choose one or the other, because not voting is a choice. But nonetheless, our prayer is that God would give us leaders who, at the very least, have a fear of God, and will follow that conscience and follow the righteousness expressed by the Word of God, not necessarily enforcing our political views or our spiritual views on others, but rather we do believe that the laws that bring order and stability into a culture should apply to everybody equally. And when they do, then there usually is harmony and prosperity and things go well. And I would say that the reason that things are not harmonious and are not going well is because our nation has moved far away from that idea of what we call that plurality, where we respect the beliefs of one another's, contrary to that, we have found that one agenda is being pushed very, very hard. And it's ironic, I find that with the current regime and those who are supportive of it, that what they are doing and what they mean and what they believe are always the opposite of what they say. I would just leave it at that for now. But I want to get on to where I want to focus my conversation with you today. And that's the fact that when Revelation, the book of Revelation, speaks about the geopolitical structure of the end times, it becomes fairly evident that the polity that's going to dominate the world in the end times is what's referred to as one world government. The term that is more current is globalism or globalization. Even people who are for global government like the term globalization because it's the idea that we have many nations, but they're really unified in one source of governance. It's interesting, but I would say that the idea of one world government is only partly true because the Book of Revelation also speaks about the kings of the Orient. And if that is applying to the geopolitical context of today, it would mean that it would clearly mean that China will be a separate entity and eventually will rebel against the political and economic hegemony that the kingdom of the beast will form. And that leads to what's called the Battle of Armageddon. So that's an important, I think, caveat to throw in here, that when we talk about one world government, we have to understand that the kings of the Orient, as Revelation 16 tells us, may be cooperative, may be forced into an economic hegemony, but they will strike out against that in the end time, and that will be the final battle of this era that we're living in and will occasion the second coming of Jesus Christ and the setting up of his millennial kingdom. It's not going to come because we have taken over the arms of government and have forced the world to submit to biblical morality as the new apostolic reformation and other people, Seven Mountain Mandates suggest. That's, again, another conversation, but I'll just leave it at that. But having made that clarification, it has remained an ongoing curiosity on the part of Bible students as to what is the exact identity of both the beast, the one world ruler, and the empire that he will govern over. Over the years, there have been a lot of candidates, usually whatever is the dominant power of the day. There certainly were those, I think, in John's time who were convinced that it would be the Roman Empire because it was clearly the dominant force in the world, and its leaders were pretty diabolical, especially Domitian, who was emperor at the time of John's writing. But it's not coincidental that Daniel and Revelation both predict the formation of a global government consisting of a handful of global powers, a confederation of 10 nations or regions. And ever since Revelation was penned, men have attempted to identify what those 10 nations might be or who they might represent. Obviously, one of the most common candidates was the Roman Empire, which continued to function in various forms until the Middle Ages, when it merely metastasized into what's called the Holy Roman Empire. And this was led by a time by the papacy. In fact, that one of the reasons why Martin Luther considered the Pope to be the Antichrist. But in more modern times, the focus is turned to the European Union as a restructuring of the Roman Empire. When it first started as an economic union, there were 10 members, but now I think there's like 27, probably more even. But so it's continued to grow. But it has in many ways exerted itself in areas that were generally under the European or under the Roman Empire. But we have to understand that only part of the Roman Empire, not the eastern part, it didn't... And the European Union doesn't include the Middle East, which was all under the control of the European Empire, as well as Egypt. Yet, even more recently, many have begun looking at the UN because it is truly a global organization and has gone from being a rather benign organization to being the center of an active effort to create a one-world government. Let me go back and talk a little bit about the history of the UN. It started about 75 years ago, following World War II, basically, which ended in 1949. At that time, many of the stronger industrial nations in the world were lying in a pile of ruins, and the world wanted peace. So representatives from 50 different countries gathered in San Francisco for 2 months, and they drafted and signed the UN Charter, which created a new international organization, which had been referred to by Franklin Roosevelt as the United Nations. And it was hoped it would prevent another world war like the one that had just been lived through. That's logical, that's reasonable. But in part, it's kind of unbiblical, because even though the founders sat down and said, we want to have a place where we can deal with crises before they become global, one of the things we find is that idea of global unity goes back to the Tower of Babel. And for that reason, God scattered the people into various national entities. So that if you want to see what God's plan after the fall was for humanity, it was for them to have national identities, not to have one single global global identity, because he said if they ever achieve that unity, this is in Genesis 11, he said there'll be no kinds of evil that will be restrained from them. We have to understand that unity is always necessary for growth, whether it be things that are good or as well as things that are evil. And the problem is, because we are sinners and because humanity tends to be sinful, we always end up on the evil side of the equation. There's no nation that has ever become powerful and had some kind of hegemonic influence or control over the world that hasn't eventually used that in some kind of profane or diabolical way. You know, basically, they're the well-intentioned dragons, if you will. And look, for example, when you look at the original charter of the UN, they stated their purpose was to maintain international peace and security, to give humanitarian assistance to those in need, and at that point there were many, to protect human rights, and to uphold international law. All of this, of course, was in the light of the Holocaust and the murder of so many tens of millions of people on the planet because of the acts of nefarious nations. And you know, it's interesting because not only do we find that there were massacres carried out by the friends of the Hitler and the Axis powers, but also even the communist powers, particularly in the Soviet Union. There were many people who were murdered and executed in a genocidal way. So, but when we look at the UN today, it goes from that basically Whitney kind of well-meaning, nefarious, good-intentioned organization to doing a lot of new work that it was never envisioned for it by its founders in 1945. I say that with some reservation, because I think that it was the intention of certain individuals, especially David Rockefeller, who gave the soil that the UN building stands on today, who very clearly spent his lifetime trying to develop a global union of nations for the purpose of bringing peace and stability, but also for the purpose of business to be able to succeed and expand itself. And so here was a man who had tremendous influence in shaping much of what we know the world to do and giving the UN the kind of control, influence, and power and globalism that it has. I can't speak to the motivations of his heart, but he says clearly in his autobiography that he was committed to creating a global government. And for him, you know, in many ways, I think it was simply the idea that business exceeds the borders of its nationhood, and many of the corporations today, of course, no longer see them as being aligned with any national entity. That's kind of the idea of, you know, buy USA is kind of a foil, because the reality is these businesses want to expand far beyond the borders of the United States, and they want to expend their capital in building business empires around the world. And it was really the thought of people like Nixon and others who began to reach out to China and so forth, certainly, that the idea was that they would create this kind of global dependency and interaction between nations because of the economic connections that they would have. China has really thrown a wrench in that gear and proved that they are determined to be world dominant and not just part of the world system. In fact, one of the problems that we find in dealing with China today is that China is running, is pushing its exports and dumping them into many, many markets. And it's really, you know, affecting the profitability of many businesses in the world. And the pressure is right now to get them to stop dumping and to focus on developing the incomes and lifestyles, the middle class of their own nation. It doesn't seem that the current leadership is concerned with that as much as having world dominance. If they can destroy the economic stability of the countries around the world, they are willing to do that because ultimately their goal is not to become profitable, but to become powerful. But back to the UN for a moment, which is greatly influenced, unfortunately, by China, as we saw following the COVID fodemic. But it was beginning back in 1995, the UN began to work on the idea of what they called sustainable development goals. And the idea was that the world was going to kill itself through pollution or because of climate or because of one thing or another. And therefore, the UN needed to unite and began to create a set of goals that would make life on Earth sustainable. There were 17 of these goals that they came in, and ultimately now they have really set 2030 as being the deadline for reaching those goals. When you hear things about 2030, where they want to eliminate gas-powered vehicles and things of that nature, you have to understand that it's all in alignment with these international goals that are being set forth by the UN. The idea is they want to achieve what they say a better and more sustainable future for us all. Many of these goals would be laudable. They want to address the problems of poverty and hunger, problems of limited education and bad health care, and helping countries to become more productive. But it's interesting because, like everything else, these things sound great, but the devil is in the detail and in the implementation. For example, they talk about gender equality. And that has gone from letting women have equal status with men to basically a avid promotion of two things. One, abortion, forcing countries, if they want to get funds, to begin to legalize abortion. And this is where they're really running into loggerheads, because you take countries like Malawi or something like that, which have basically a Christian heritage, and even many Muslim nations, which are anti-abortion. They're saying if you want to get development funds, you have to make it legal for women to get abortion, to have contraception, and every other thing that they think is important for making women happy and equal. But now it's even metastasized beyond that. It's the whole LGBTQ agenda that's being promoted. I don't have time to go into documentation on that, but I think it's fairly obvious. It doesn't take a great deal of research to find out that this is actually being pressured and pushed on many countries who still hold to the idea that there are only two genders, male and female. The idea of climate change, secondly, intervention, the idea that they begin to eliminate things that they think are expanding our carbon footprint. Now, even though carbon dioxide only makes up about 0.002% of our gases in the atmosphere, and even though carbon dioxide is absolutely necessary for plant growth, that's how plants feed off of carbon dioxide, and where the carbon dioxide levels go up, places become more verdant, more productive. Yet, nonetheless, they have bought into this idea, or at least this propaganda, that somehow we have to eliminate carbon dioxide so that we will live safely and life won't be extinguished on the planet. And it's amazing. It just isn't in our own country. It's around the world, even more so in many European countries, that many young people have come to believe it with all their heart. I mean, you think about people like Greta Thunberg, who is this autistic young lady who has never really finished her education, but she has become the spokesperson because she's so outrageous and so outlandish in her protests to the world leaders. And somehow that's viewed as being very noble. The reality is it's misguided. And it's unfortunate to see a young person being used and manipulated to further the desires of other people. You even find people like Al Gore, I think, who jump on this bandwagon because they're so embittered. He's so embittered over his loss of the presidential election, and also because he has to have some kind of relevance. You know, there's something I'm doing that's important, that matters. And so you have all these different motivations behind why people are doing this, but it's not based in science. It's based in a political agenda. It's trying to basically ultimately get to the real issue with this wealth and resource redistribution. The idea that wealthy countries, particularly the United States, should have a lower standard of living that would be equal or equitable with the rest of the world. And that's where the word equity becomes so misleading, because the idea of equity means that everything is all the same. Well, that never has been. It never will be. In fact, Jesus said, "The poor you will always have with you," because poverty is not simply a function of a lack of money. It's often a fact that it's a consequence of bad ideas and bad behavior, sloth and cultural mindsets that are counterproductive to prosperity. And that's what one of the things we find in the world today is there's a lot of people who have cultures that cause them to be ineffectual. They don't value hard work. They don't value discipline. They don't understand the idea of savings. But more importantly, the UN's own resources or studies have shown that the real chief cause of poverty is injustice and oppression, oppressive regimes that where the leadership steals from the people so that they might enrich themselves personally. I think one of the classic examples of this is what we see going on in the Middle East. Palestine, you know, Yasser Arafat died with $1 billion in personal assets. His wife did not, and child did not live in Palestine. They lived in Paris in a $10,000 a month apartment, living a life of grandeur and luxury. And the same thing is true. I remember when the U.S. and the European Union began to send loads of money into them to the Palestinian Authority, suddenly you start seeing these mansions popping up all over the hillsides. These were the people who were in positions of power. So the same way we see even with a Hamas leadership, or that they're living in, you know, luxury in Qatar and other places like that, far away from the hardships that the average Gazan is living with. And what they've done is they've manipulated people's religious fervor to turn it into a genocidal lifestyle. And essentially to call it anything other than that is not to know the facts or choose not to know the facts. Therefore, what all of these things will require is a kind of a global control. There needs to be a centralization, one world government that can be basically in control of how those resources and assets are distributed. And one of the things I found in these kind of socialistic and even communistic systems is, as it says in the book Animal Farm, that all the animals were equal, but some animals are more equal than the others. And that's what communism is all about, that those people who are on top seem to have greater needs for special things, so that even though the government may require us to get rid of all of our gas-guzzling cars, the president often boasts of having a gas-guzzling vintage Corvette in his garage and is driven around in very heavy gas-guzzling armor-plated Suburbans, you know, that he uses to transport him from place to place. It may be good for the goose, but it's not good for the gander. Well, so however that goes. So anyway, the idea is that this idea of one world government, especially as it's expressed through unofficial partner organizations like the World Economic Forum, which tends to coincide with the UN Sustainable Government Goals. In particular, they have come out very openly and said they want to see an end of American dominance. The world, they said, should be controlled by a handful of global powers, and which sounds so much like the 10 nations of Revelation and Daniel 9, that this would, of course, if it happened, it would really have to be the end of the republic and the suppression of the U.S. Constitution. No longer would the primary law governing American lifestyles be the Constitution, but it would be supposedly under the U.N. Charter, but there would be no one committed to defending it. That's why I think in many ways we see the current attack on the First Amendment as not being compatible with internet or social media goals. Again, there are many people in positions of influence and power who believe that we have to rewrite the First Amendment because it gives too much freedom and suppresses or hinders government from being able to do all it wants to do, which, by the way, was the whole reason that the First Amendment was the First Amendment and why it was written the way it was written, because those founders knew that they couldn't trust government to protect the rights of people, and they would seek to silence voices that they felt interfered with their agenda. Now, there are those who would argue, well, the UN Charter basically mirrors those very same things of freedom of religion, freedom of opinion, freedom of expression, and assembly. But it is unlike the U.S. Constitution, and what makes the U.S. Constitution unique is that it is the First Amendment, the most important, the most central amendment following the Articles of Incorporation of the Nation. Basically, it was said, this is first and foremost of importance to us. that we might be able to have freedom to believe and to exercise that belief in every way that we want, and that there should be no interference, and that if they do, that we have the right to state our grievances to our government. Now, it's interesting because in the UN Charter, they basically list 30 different articles of the rights of people, and religious freedom is number 18. Freedom of opinion and expression is number 19, and number 20 is that we should be able to assemble peacefully. But it's interesting because, as is always the case, when lawyers begin to interpret laws, it's amazing what they can do with it. I think that in order to be a lawyer, it's increasingly incumbent upon a person to be freed from any kind of moral value. In other words, there's kind of an amorality that governs the idea of being a legal representative of a criminal. I mean, you can't represent somebody that you know is guilty and then go into court and say, my client is guilty and he should receive the just payment of his reward. You know, basically that would be considered to be unfair. But the whole point is that at the same time, it means that those who practice law are put into a precarious situation that they really have to suspend their own moral judgments. And I don't think any of us does that very successfully without ending up being compromised. Very rarely do you hear of a lawyer saying, I won't take that case, I won't represent that person because I think that would be wrong and they need to be judged. And so as a result, we find that for career advantage and prosperity, many times people have to compromise their conscience. What the 18th article of the UN Charter says is everyone has the right to freedom of thought and conscience and religion. It goes on to say that we should have the freedom to change our religion if we want, or our belief, the freedom, either alone or in community with others, in public or private, to manifest his religious beliefs in teaching, practice, worship, observance. That's fine on its face. But you see, what's happening is it becomes compromised to the point where he's saying, you can believe whatever you want, but you can't necessarily promote everything you want. And there are many countries who are in good standing with the United Nations who basically punish people who are converted, and they go after the persons who have done the conversion and not just simply the person who has been converted, so that they make it into a criminal act where you force this person to believe in something that they would not otherwise have believed. And so it's that turning things on their head that suddenly the freedom is taken away. Even the 19th article, which says a freedom of opinion and expression, they say we should have the freedom to hold whatever opinions we want without interference and to seek, receive impartial information and ideas through any media and regardless of the frontiers. Well, again, we find that this is not something that any of these nations agree with. In fact, even our own, where the government is currently facing the Supreme Court with the issue of, do they have the right to control what they consider to be misinformation? The internet has proved to be so powerful that most people who are in positions of power are threatened by it because they're not prepared to confront the issue with their own ideas, but rather they want to clear out away any kind of opposing idea. So it's not surprising that as we look at our media today, and probably, you know, you look at the main major media operations, they are basically all of one opinion and one mind. And the fact that they use the same exact verbiage every time they cover a story gives you the idea that they have been given a list of talking points that they all follow. And basically, they are endeavoring by every means to silence any other opinion that they disregard or think is a violation. There was no clear example. I know that many of you already know this, but no clear example. And we saw what happened with COVID. And I think right now, where the CDC has just removed its warnings about ivermectin, in part, basically they said it was not an effective medication. But the truth of the matter is, it's the most successful medication that's ever been created, with the least side effects and harms, and has proven to be effective, even they're finding in some cases with cancer. But yet, nonetheless, it was restricted and we couldn't be dispensed during COVID, even though it had been shown over and over again to have positive results. And the media carried the water of the pharmaceutical organizations, which are wholly owned and bought, controlling of the CDC and the World Health Organization and everything else. Basically, they control the media. So basically, what is the truth and who can impart information ideas, regardless of the frontiers? Well, they decide what the frontiers are. They decide what are the ideas that can be promoted. The 20th article basically says everyone has a right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association. But we have to, again, go by how do you define assembly and association, and how do you define peaceful? We saw the riots that broke out all over the United States because of the George Floyd farce. And basically portraying him as a hapless victim of police brutality when, in fact, he was a thief, he was a drug addict. Some people said, how can you say that he was a Christian? Well, he was a backslidden Christian if, in fact, he was a Christian, because he was living a criminal and addictive lifestyle. And we know now that from the autopsy that he died of heart failure, which was a condition he'd had. He wasn't choked to death by a man's knee being on his neck. All of this was so very sad, and yet it's led to such a terrible series of events. And all of us famously know the CNN reporter standing in front of a burning building and saying it was mostly a peaceful assembly or demonstration, when in fact billions of dollars of damage was done, hundreds of people were injured, a significant number of people were killed and murdered and abused. It was a terrible thing, and yet they chose to represent it as something that was obviously not what it was. And then they say, of course, in the 20th article, no one may be compelled to belong to an association. It's interesting. Again, it's all in the legalese, if you will. What do you mean by compelled? If I'm, you know, my thought would be that if I don't want to belong to something, I shouldn't have to. And yet, if you can't get a job, if you don't take a vaccine, or you're fired from your job, isn't that really compulsion? It's compulsion of association and disassociation. So I come back to the First Amendment. You know, basically it says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishing a religion. In other words, you can't have a state religion, or the prohibiting of the free exercise thereof. In other words, its government should keep its stinking fingers off of religion completely. End of conversation. They should not be involved in bridging the freedom of speech or the press, or the right of the people to peacefully assemble and to petition the government to redress of grievances. And so the idea of the court system exists so that we can go to court and protect ourselves from the overreach of government. That's something that is being taken away very quickly, but also, understandably, it's not a value that is really embraced by the majority of member nations of the United Nations, which most of them do not have a legal system that functions with any kind of fairness. You see, the goal again, though, is not to replace the nation states, but to limit their autonomy and their authority and make them subservient to the 190 member states of the United Nations. So when the United Nations just passed a resolution to demand a ceasefire on the part of Israel, who are they working for? Well, most of them are despotic countries who really have an interest in agreeing with the UN, or agreeing with China in particular, in the Muslim states, as well as Russia. And in short, what happens is national sovereignty will become abridged and will then be moderated through the UN, so that basically your rights are passed through the filter of the United Nations. Now, keep in mind that over 90% of the member nations are non-democratic, including key members of the Security Council. When you talk about China and Russia, two of the most autocratic, domineering, non-democratic states in the world. And farcically, I mean, you find, for example, the Human Rights Commission is currently chaired by Saudi Arabia, which forbids conversion to Christianity or any other religion, and has treats women as chattel and doesn't allow them hardly any freedoms whatsoever. It even has member nations like North Korea and China, who are in charge of human rights. And the overall disposition of these member nations is anti-U.S. and Israel. And that's why to this very day, we don't find that the U.N. has condemned what Hamas did in invading Israel and murdering almost 1,300 people in the most horrific ways. And that's interesting, you know, that they are silent on that, but they're very quick to point out that Israel is guilty of genocide. They not only don't know what the meaning of the word genocide is by definition, definition, but also it really speaks to the fact that they are really answering to someone else other than the God in heaven. On paper, and that's why I find the center or the core, the governing heart of the United Nations, supposedly and theoretically, is the UN Security Council, which is the executive council of the United Nations. On paper, it has 15 members, but it's interesting because it has 5 permanent members, and each with its own veto power: China, France, Russia, UK, and the United States. Now, in the latest resolution to force a ceasefire in Israel, the U.S. abstained from voting. Previously, they would veto it and it would die there, but they chose to abstain because we know that in an effort to respond to a constituency within the Democratic Party, the president is trying to play both sides of the fence. He supports Israel. He doesn't support Israel. And so rather than voting to veto, they voted to simply abstain and say nothing. But here's what's interesting. There's 5 permanent members, but there's also 15 regional representatives, which we would say would make 20. But in fact, those 5 regions each have one representative vote. There's the African states, there's the Asia Pacific, there's Eastern Europe, there's Latin America, and there's Western Europe. I wonder, is it possible that from the form of the Kingdom of Beast is going to be composed of these 5 permanent members and the 5 regional representatives, that they're the 10 kingdoms? I mean, it's certainly a possibility, and it's only a speculation. I'm not saying that prophetically that this is it, because others would argue, I think particularly from the point of view of the World Economic Forum, that they should be dominant economic powers. But you're going to find again the UN and its 190 members most of them are not going to be in agreement with that. Now, keep in mind that only 14% of the UN's 193 member states are considered full democracies. Nearly 40% are flawed democracies. What does that mean? Ukraine, where they have suspended voting. India, which is questionable whether they're truly democratic. 40% of them are outright totalitarian states like Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, Ethiopia, most of the Middle East for that matter. And 2, again, of the 5 permanent members of the UN are totalitarian states. That would be Russia and China. Undoubtedly, in a future time of international crisis, these people will give their power to one individual of incredible intellectual and spiritual and persuasive charisma to lead the world out of whatever crisis that may be, whether it's real or it's manufactured. Now, the idea of a manufactured crisis seems kind of abstract, and yet we find that going back to Winston Churchill, he was the first one to say that you shouldn't waste a crisis, and we found it being repeated by Rahm Emanuel, who was part of President Clinton's staff and has been really an operational principle for many within the despotic regime that we find ourselves dealing with today. But you understand that throughout the UN's history, they've been involved in a number of what we call real international crises. Even the U.S.'s involvement in the Korean War, it was basically something that was signed off by the United Nations. And part of the reason it was is because Russia was boycotting the UN at the time, and so they weren't there to veto the effort. And so basically, the war in Korea against the Chinese invasion of the South was something that was mobilized by the U.S. and certainly supported by it for the most part. But it was considered to be a position that the United Nations was taking in order to stop aggression. You know, over the past 70 years, more than 1 million men and women have served under the UN flag in more than 70 UN peacekeeping operations. We've been to Korea, Kosovo, Middle East, in the Sudan, and certainly up in Lebanon, we've seen them. I've seen many U.S. Troops, you know, in Israel and on the Lebanese border and so forth. And, you know, basically their job is to see a problem and to run away. They just really don't, as we saw in Rwanda, basically had no power to stop what was going on. Basically, that's led to the call for many to form a formal UN army under the command of the United Nations and supported and supplied by the member states, primarily the United States. And yet, everywhere the UN army has been, there have been terrible stories of abuse and corruption. And on the positive side, the UN has been involved in famine relief in Africa and Asia. And yet on another level, over the past 3 or 4 decades, there have been two key shifts I see in the UN's focus and policy. First, there's been a key change in the key positions of leadership. From the leaders used to be primarily from democratically Western-focused and trained and educated leaders, many who understood and appreciated the value of democracy and freedom of speech and religion and so forth, to now it's shifted to second and third world leaders committed to socialism. In fact, the current Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, was previously the head of the Portuguese Socialist Party and is an avowed socialist, if not in fact communist. He is no friend of America. And the head of the World Health Organization is Tedros is an Ethiopian. And Ethiopia is an authoritarian regime, not a democracy. And it's becoming the key representative of the nations which are under the banner of the United Nations. So that when we look at these people, they come from non-democratic nations with no history or legacy of personal rights and freedoms. And we've basically taken some of the weakest leaders of the weakest nations and put them in the positions of greatest influence. And I think they are men who are enamored with that power. Wouldn't you be? If you grew up in a depressed country and suddenly you're finding yourself sitting in one of the most powerful positions in the world. But the second change I've seen is the UN has been in search of a crisis big enough to bring about a coalescence of all the nations into a single cause. You see, for decades, they promoted overpopulation as being the greatest threat to humanity. It's the thing that pushed the U.S. into legalizing abortion. Yet the world's population is currently in decline, and population has never been the driver of poverty. Rather, it's oppressive regimes with their robber leaders who have stolen the goods of the people and kept the people in poverty because there's no way that they can move forward. And that's become increasingly true even of Western countries. You know, people kind of wonder, why do the Muslims in countries like Britain and France become so angry and riot and demonstrate? And it's because those are stratified countries. They're stratified socially, they're stratified economically. In other words, as much as they may talk about their racial tolerance, they look at people who are non-white Europeans with a lesser degree of respect. And it's just a simple fact. And people who move there thinking they're going to be treated fairly find out that they are not, and they become very angry about it. Well, bottom line, one of the things we find that even by our standards, these countries are not open. So what they did was in the early 2000s, they came up with something that was even more effective. They came up with the pandemic. And they began talking about that in the early 2000s and saying that we're due for some major pandemic that's going to threaten humanity. And they point back to the swine flu of 1918, which killed probably 60 million people around the world and about 150,000. In fact, my paternal grandfather was in Paris, France during World War I, and he was a medical doctor, and he died from the swine flu. It was, you know, basically they call it the Spanish flu because the Spanish media was the first one who openly published about the fact that there was this flu epidemic going around the world that was killing people. But ultimately, because that didn't happen, it found expression in the COVID, what I call faux-demic now. Even now, the WHO is pressing the what they call Pandemic X. And the head of the WHO recently in a speech made it very clear that there is this pandemic. We call it X because we don't know what it is. We don't know where it's going to come from. We don't know what it's going to look like. We don't know when it'll arrive on the scene. But we need to give unprecedented power to the World Health Organization over the world's health systems by international agreement, or they call it an arrangement, to be signed actually this May, next month. I mean, think about that. The United States is online to sign this. The Biden administration is going to sign this arrangement. And you see, the problem is they call it an arrangement because it's really a treaty. And for a treaty to be passed, it has to go through Congress, and it would never survive Congress. And so they just call it an arrangement. But essentially, the Biden administration will instruct the CDC and every other organ of health systems in the United States to submit to whatever guidelines that the WHO puts forward. Now, considering how they handled the pandemic, the COVID or faux-demic, not few of us have any confidence in their leadership. Certainly, they were paid and bought for by the communist Chinese. But you see, before and after the faux-demic, having been discovered or proven that they could control the world's nations by fear, disinformation, and by intimidation. They have pushed all sorts of other agendas like global cooling and then global warming, and now they call it climate change because the Earth has neither shown that it's cooling or it's warming. It's faux science all the way. Even the latest report that came out of NOAA, the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Association, which is a arm of the U.S. government, they said it was the hottest temperatures on the history of recording temperatures. Well, it was discovered that they were placing many of their measurements, their monitors, in cities near asphalt and concrete, and some were even found next to heating ducts, which artificially inflated the number. You know what it reminds me of is when I was a kid and I was wanted to get out of school, so I'd go to the school nurse and tell her I was running a fever. She would put the thermometer in my mouth, and when she turned her back, I would take it out and put it under my arm, in my armpit. And of course, it would get much hotter. And then when she came back in, I put the thermometer back in my mouth, and what do you know? My temperature was high, and so I got to go home. That's basically what's going on with NOAA and, of course, the IPCC and all the other organizations that work on climate change. And see, that's the thing, is that UN member states have also agreed to climate action to limit global warming. And if you go to their website, you'll find out they have statements like, it's time for global cooperation. In fact, one quote from Antonio Guterres, who is the Secretary General of the UN, said that this is the era of fossil fuels, that must come to an end with justice and equity. Now, just a side note, fossil fuels is a misnomer, that we don't know that oil comes from fossils. In fact, there are not enough fossils in the ground to produce the kind of oil that's there. So even that is kind of a fake moniker that they put over the things, fossil fuel, as if we're living off the dead bodies of ancient creatures. But one of the things that Guterres said is these developing countries must be supported every step of the way. In other words, third world countries should be helped to develop basically energy-free zones so they can prosper. In other words, all they need is more access to energy in order to compete. The truth of the matter is, if you have a corrupt system, it doesn't matter how much energy you have, it will always end up filling the pockets of the wealthy and the powerful and not the poor, which is essentially what's happening already. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer around the world. But according to one of their top advisors, Guterres's top advisors on climate, she basically said that she calls for white people to be stripped of power in revolutionary fights, adding that racial harmony is a fallacy. In other words, she's calling for race war. And she is one of his closest, most intimate advisors. But if you look at the UN's website and they talk about actions they recommend, they talk about how we need to work for our common future. And there are steps that every one of us can take for a healthier planet. And they write, act now, speak up, and show leaders that people are ready for change. And what are some of the recommendations? Number one, save energy at home. Switch all your lights to LED lights and energy efficient electric appliances, washing your laundry with cold water or by hand, hanging things out to dry instead of using a dryer. Well, let me put it this way. If you live in the South, that also includes limiting or putting an end to air conditioning. If you live in the North, they want to limit your heating, that you move your thermostat so you're not comfortable. And hanging your clothes out to dry in Spokane, Washington, in the middle of winter, are you kidding? They might freeze, but they certainly would never dry. So, I mean, all of this stuff is just so much nonsense, because really what they want to do is limit the amount of electricity that we consume, because most of electricity is created by coal generation, as China is proving by building a coal generating plant just about every day across their country. They have no interest in joining with us in this effort. They also, you need to change your home's source of energy. It says, ask your utility company if your energy comes from oil, coal, or gas. Now here, gas is non-polluting, and most of the coal has been limited, and even oil production has dropped dramatically. And it goes on and says, if possible, see if you can switch to renewable sources such as wind or solar. Now, I know in our part of the country, solar is off the table. And what if you have solar panels and you get a terrible storm that destroys the panels? It happens. Or what about wind? What do you do when it doesn't blow? In fact, in our part of the country, it can blow very hard, but sometimes we don't have any wind. We just have a lot of cold air. And then they say, stop driving your car. Walk, take a bike, or take public transportation. For me, I live 5 miles from my church. I live 8 miles from the city center. I'm going to ride a bike, and there is no public transportation. And if you go to electric buses, most of those have been pulled out of service because they don't work very well. And that's why they say you should switch to an electric vehicle. Well, do I need to say any more that most of us understand at this point that electric vehicles are unreliable? They're a long ways from being safe and dependable, and even the problem of being able to charge them. It's incredible. So that we find that the reality is the marketplace tells us the truth about these things. They can't sell electric cars. They're stuck with them, and so the manufacturers are going away from it, and yet the government says by 2030 that 70% of our vehicles that are sold will have to be electric. So the real effect is it destroys the automakers, which is kind of their goal. They tell us also to travel less. Part of the wonder of the vehicle in the modern world is that we can travel more, that we can go all over the world, we can see things, but we can go see our family and friends who live around the world or around the nation when we have the opportunity to do so. And what they're saying is they want you to spend more time at home and become less sophisticated, less exposed, and have less experience. I mean, it's crazy. It's really a terrible thing. They want us to go back to simpler times. And then lastly, they said, eat vegetables rather than meat and recycle. In fact, this whole idea that the World Economic Forum is promoting is that we should eat pulverized crickets. And even recently, they said for meat eaters, they should switch to python meat because the pythons reproduce so quickly, probably by eating chickens. But I mean, so much of this, even the idea of calling for the White House to no longer have the Easter egg hunt, but rather to have a potato hunt. All of this is so nonsensical, because if it was practical and it was workable and doable, the market would take care of that. But they don't like the idea of free market. In fact, we find that our government is increasingly favoring the elitists who run monopolies and want the rest of us to have to become subservient. Part of the one most amazing things is the pandemic pushed people into no longer shopping from local markets, but going online. I myself and my wife and I have thought about how much more we buy online that's delivered right to our house and how quickly it gets here. I order a thing one day and the next day it's on my front porch. And boy, that is cheaper and easier than driving to the store. But you know, we also lose? We lose the interaction. We lose the small businesses. So instead of small business being flourished, they're being pushed out by the conglomerates like Amazon. And instead of going to the store and seeing your neighbors and interacting with them, you're suddenly forced into a isolated existence. Oh, but they've got a solution for that, and that is basically creating these small urban centers where they call them 15-minute cities, where you can reach everything in your community in 15 minutes. They're all in walking distance, which means that your choices become fewer. And I think probably those cities will be clogged with Amazon vans and their contractors, because people won't be able to get what they want through their local community operations, which will probably end up being state-run stores. But again, one of the principal objectives of the UN is to solve economic, social, cultural, and humanitarian issues through this idea of international cooperation. So what the UN has done is over the years formed 15 specialized agencies that carry out various functions on behalf of the United Nations. Now, the UN's regular peacekeeping budget, when they don't have special things, is around $3.4 billion. And a quarter of that is for special political missions, things like UNRWA, which was the United Nations World Relief Organization in Gaza, which has basically funneled tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars into Gaza, which in turn have been used to build underground tunnels. But they have over 40,000 employees in various duty stations around the world. Most of this is paid by the United States, by the way. Do you understand that we basically fund the United Nations? Most of the countries, of course, can't afford to do it. It's kind of like NATO. We commit to supporting, but we don't really do it. So if we don't pay our bills, nobody's going to come to us. But there are three organizations which really stand out in my mind. First of all is the International Monetary Fund, which really is increasingly taking control of the world's economic systems or its monetary systems and is moving us very quickly into a digitized currency system that'll be worldwide. Their goal ultimately is to establish one world financial system or monetary system so that there is equity and parity around the world. This will be disastrous for the U.S. economy because we, being the primary reserve currency and able to control our overspending by printing more money and don't have to pay for it, whereas other countries have to. So that irritation at the unfairness of the United States' leverage economically is one of the things that is pushing for ending fiat currency, we call dollars as such, and to go to an international currency that is digital and that everybody has to play by the same rules. Of course, the World Bank is part of that operation, as well as the World Trade Organization, which ironically declares that China and India, two of the largest polluters and producers in the world, are still developing economies and therefore are given special rights and privileges and released from certain obligations and tariffs and so forth. But then there's also the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. It's basically designed to assess the science related to climate change. Now, there is no true science in climate change. When man created his hockey stick model where the climate was level and all of a sudden it spiked in the 2000s. And that's been proven to be a fabrication, that only exists in his mind and on paper. It's not something that is verifiable by any kind of climatologist. But the idea is to create a narrative increasingly that promotes the idea that we need to move towards a global solution. And the current regime that runs our country is heads, feet, and shoulder into that. They are people who no longer believe in the United States as a democracy. They no longer believe in the Constitution. They believe that we are unfairly advantaged against the rest of the world and need to be brought into control. Then there's the UN Population Division, which job is to slow population growth. And they're the ones who are promoting contraception, abortion, and have also picked up the idea of LGBT community, because you understand that if you're part of the LGBTQ community, you're sterile. You can't reproduce. And so therefore, the more we spread that ideology, the more we can control population growth. What's most interesting, though, as I said, that the World Health Organization acts as kind of the coordinating authority on international public health. It deals with, you know, things like health and sanitation and disease and sends medical teams to face and combat pandemics. It's located in Geneva, Switzerland, which is pretty nice digs. But again, I come back to this whole idea that we're going to see very quickly. But they're with this push of against disease X and giving new power to the almost autonomous power to the World Health Organization. They're the ones who are calling for vaccine passports, and they're the ones promoting the pandemic treaty, the ones who want to enforce mass vaccination, many of which are proving to be greater threats to our health than any disease we might get. Well, I've covered a lot of information, and I hope it hasn't been overwhelming to you, but I really want you to keep your eye on things like the United Nations. You know, most of us think whatever, and we don't want to be troubled by it. But I think that if we should pay closer attention to what they're doing and saying, because I think it's a real possibility that the one world government and the Antichrist will rise out of this organization. Some people say, what about the World Economic Forum? Well, the World Economic Forum and the UN are lockstepped with each other. They work in concert. They have the same talking points. So you have one, you have the other. Am I saying the UN is going to be the world government? No, but it's certainly... It walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it certainly swims like a duck. It certainly has all the indicators of being the vehicle that could be the precipitant of something else. So it's just a suggestion, but I want us to, you know, strive to obey Jesus, to be watching and to be ready and prepared. As things get darker, as I said, that we go deeper. And I think that means it's wise for us to keep our eye on organizations like the United Nations. Well, I've said enough. I thank you for hanging with me through this time, and I pray that God will guide and direct your thoughts. Nothing I say should be taken as the absolute final word on anything. A lot of it is speculative, and I wish many of my colleagues and peers would be honest enough to say that. But then again, it doesn't necessarily serve the interests of the prophecy industry that is kind of plaguing the church these days. But enough said about all of that. Look forward to coming up with something else. If, for those of you who are complaining that I don't do this frequently enough, I appreciate that. I just don't want to be retreading the same tire as I find many people do. And it takes some time to develop some perspective on some of these issues that I think is worthwhile sharing with you. So I hope you can appreciate that. And I appreciate the fact that you would take any time to follow me in this. God bless you and go in His grace. As things get darker, let's go deeper in Jesus. Amen.